Welcome to Generation Dry. I'm Kayla.
And I'm Leah. Let's jump in.
So welcome. And I just want to share to our listeners, Kayla is not here. She has COVID. So she's recovering. And so it's just me and our guest, Rachel, today. I'm excited to meet you.
So excited.
And so we have a lot to cover. I read your bio. Like, I know we chatted in the group chat for a little bit. And so I know there's a lot we could talk about, but I think this being a mental health podcast for those that are sober, sober curious, or in recovery in some aspect, I just want to start with, like, and I know you, again, I read your bio, but for listeners that don't know, or don't follow you, or you have, you know, this presence online, but what, I guess, made you this advocate for mental health and mental health? Yeah.
Access. I love this question. I started working with mental health after I was diagnosed with bipolar 1 disorder and borderline personality disorder, which my therapist actually calls emotional regulation disorder because there's such a negative connotation with BPD. Mm-hmm. So I like to call it emotional regulation disorder. Mm-hmm. And once I got diagnosed with that, which was in my late 20s, you know, I was suffering with mental illness since I was like 8 years old, mm-hmm. From trauma and PTSD and things like that. But I didn't have a conversation about it till my late 20s, because, you know, people just didn't talk about it ever. And then I started to see that my little sibling was actually struggling with that. So they were having a lot of the same symptoms that I did. So I was like, okay, you need to get to a doctor. You're 14. This will, you know, work itself out. So when I told them to go to therapy, I was like, okay, like I need to stick with it, stay in therapy and kind of work out what is happening to me. Mm-hmm. And then after, you know, I got older and I had a suicide attempt as an adult, cause I had had them as a child, but as like a 29-year-old adult, 26-year-old adult to be attempting something like that, it really made me want to help my community a little more. Cause I was like, okay, if this is affecting me, mm-hmm. God knows who else it's affecting. Yeah. So I started working with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I was living in LA at the time. So I was their social media chair for their Los Angeles chapter. And then when I moved to New York, I started volunteering with the New York City chapter, did a couple of community walks and different fundraisers. And then I started working with the North Jersey chapter as well, since it was just in the same tri-state area. And I do some public speaking for them. I shared my story at a Survivor Day event. And then I fundraise for NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I do a couple of podcasts and a couple of interviews and public speaking about psychedelic medicine and how that can help mental illness and alcoholism, for sure, since we're going to be talking about booze anyway.
Right.
I like to explore, you know, what they're doing with psychedelics and how it's starting to be seen as a cure for something as severe as alcoholism, something that's never had a cure before.
I know. I think people, you know, especially when there was like the war on drugs, it was all substances, all medications were like, I think there was just so much stigma because of the greater drug problem, which makes sense. But then it, I think, became difficult for people to access these alternative treatments that have proven to be super effective because of just the stigma, the fear, and obviously FDA stuff. Like, it's not like just like people can go and access it. But so interesting you mentioned that. I wanted to ask you really quickly. So, because you mentioned, and this is the therapist email, you're like, I noticed this in my, I'm not trying to do therapy, but
no,
like,
it's okay. You can, I'm like, when I said that there's nothing off limits, my whole shtick, my whole thing with my social presence is I don't sugarcoat shit ever.
I love that. Yeah. And that's the same with me. I'm like, I'm a therapist on Instagram, and I hate like that Instagram therapy thing, but I also am like, well, I'm going to talk, I take medication, I have anxiety, like, this is normal. And as therapists also have shit. Like, if a therapist pretends that they don't have stuff that they're going through, then I mean, I don't know if I trust them. So anyways, yeah,
exactly.
But you mentioned your sibling started struggling. And so that's what's a catalyst to help you kind of become more reflective in your own stuff. Cause you, it sounds like they were the motivator initially, your sibling.
Yeah. They were the motivator just because it's, you know how we all treat ourselves a lot worse than we treat other people, you know, and that's my baby sibling. I'm so in love with, you know, my sisters, with Rebecca, who is the one who was struggling, you know, and just seeing them go through that, I had to kind of step in and be like, okay, we're talking about this now. I won't talk about it when it's me. I'll keep my mouth shut. I'll deal with it when I move out and I'm an adult, but we need to talk about this like right now because it was them, you know? So yeah. That kind of made me be introspective and really want to look into it.
Yeah. And so then you were seeing some parallels and were like, oh, like I could benefit also from these things.
Yeah, we were seeing some parallels, and like when self-harm starts getting into the mix, especially at a young age, it's really terrifying for parents, but also for the rest of the family that are dealing with it. So I was trying to do everything in my power to bring this conversation to my family because my family had never spoken about it. It was cute. Like when I got diagnosed, my mom was like Googling everything to do with bipolar and like trying to figure out how to fix it. And I'm like, just bear with me here. But yeah, my sibling was the catalyst for me to bring that conversation into my home and into my environment.
Like even, you know, a lot of, especially like generation, like baby boomers, and I mean, it's not like it didn't exist, mental illness or mental health challenges. Like that's always been a thing, but now there's becoming increasingly more awareness around it. Do you know, is there like a family, it sounds like, is there, could be a family history as well?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
And I was playing Russian roulette on both sides of my parents' family, unfortunately. I even actually got my dad to start going to therapy, which was a huge, huge thing, you know, for someone his age to be able to go to therapy. But yeah, like on my mom's side, we have addiction that runs in the family. And then on my dad's side, we have bipolar and addiction that run in the family. I mean, he's been sober for 25 years. You know, he really kind of saved me when I started getting clean.
Yeah.
So it runs in the family, and, you know, not everybody who has addicts and, you know, mental illness in their family is going to have it, but, you know, I got the flush of it. So I'm just dealing with the aftermath of that now.
Yeah. But I do think it's important to acknowledge that, because I think when I work with clients and we look at like family history, I'm like, and a lot of them are like, well, they're like, my parents, like one of them could possibly be depressed or have some mood disorder now that I'm thinking about it. And it's like, there's definitely that possibility. Just nobody, it wasn't treated. It was going untreated and it led to trauma, or there was trauma that activated, you know, it's all like, which came first, the chicken or the egg. But I think to acknowledge that I actually think that helps with the stigma. I think for some people it's scary to acknowledge that, but I think you know, okay, there's also this chemical component, this genetic component, which I think just helps to normalize it versus like it's something that's wrong with you versus, you know, just like,
yeah,
a medical condition.
I think, like, you know, we always, I feel like as mental health advocates, you know, we always talk about if you had a broken arm, a broken leg, you would go straight to the hospital. If you have one of these mental illnesses where there's, you know, it's not just from your behavior or your environment, it makes people feel a little more like, okay, like you said, you know, it's not, you know, my fault or anything like that.
Right.
And I think they're afraid also to realize that it's both, right? It's chemical, you know, but it's also environmental. People don't want to admit that their parents, you know, fucked them up. I always tell my therapist that my parents should be paying for therapy, because if you break it, you buy it. But, you know, I feel like people also, they're afraid to admit that we're broken,
yeah.
But we are. Like, I, sometimes that sounds bad. People are like, oh, I'm so whole, I'm so happy. Like, the cleaner I get off of substances and the longer I go to therapy, I'm just realizing that we're broken in like a really beautiful way, and none of us have our shit figured out. So
not one person. And if they do, they're living in delusion. Like, and it, maybe that helps them, but like, it doesn't help with building connection. I agree with you. And I think what's really, I talk because I have, you know, clients that are parents, and then I, you know, my parents, it sounds like yours are also wonderful. Like, my parents are wonderful in so many ways, but like in every family, there's dysfunction. In every family, there's some dynamic. It just, I don't know anybody who can say they had a perfect childhood. I know not one person. And so then also when my clients that are parents are like really concerned about fucking up and messing up their kids, I'm like, you're probably going to do it. Like, it's, like, I hate to break it to you, and I'm not in a terrible way. I'm like, all you can do is take accountability, take care of yourself, role model healthy behaviors. Like, you go to therapy, you know, you take it, you know, if you yell or have a moment where you're short with them, like, that, you're human. Like, just, you're eventually going to own it. They could have shit that comes from it. They could go to therapy and be like, my mom did this, and they probably will. But like, as I think once you realize as a child that your parents are human, and again, this varies because I think there are also some pretty, they're parents that probably shouldn't be parents. I'm not saying like you should have, we should have empathy for all parents, but.
Oh, facts. Absolutely. You know, like,
yeah.
My parents are really good now with my younger siblings. They're the coolest with them, and I'm jealous, and I feel so wrong, but I'm so jealous because they were so different when I was a kid. And because they're probably going to listen to this, I'm not going to talk about that, but yeah, they're such good people now. And that's only because they started working on their mental health, you know, and it's really crazy. You know, you see people doing gentle parenting, and then you see people doing really aggressive parenting. And my thing, you know, I'm not a parent, but you know, when I am one day, you just treat them like people. It's like, just there's people, because they're just people, you know. And I feel like it's not that difficult. And all the moms on here are gonna be like, I really don't think it's that difficult to just be nice to them.
Well, no. So I think it's not difficult to be like, they're human and they have big feelings. Like, they're just like us. They have big feelings. I think it's probably, I mean, I'm not a parent either. Like, I think the parenting part and like your patience is tested, and like you, like, especially if you're a single parent, like that can weigh on you, but it's not difficult to be like, oh, their feelings are valid. Like, even though they're 2 years old or 3 years old or 1 year old, right? Like their feelings are valid. I think with teens too, God, so many people should talk teens, and teens are just like, this is a whole nother level for teens right now in this world. So yeah,
it's really wild. And having, you know, two of them as siblings just really kind of shows me, because I can watch what's happening. You know, one of them's in college, one of them is working, and it's really strange to see it. It's always been my dream. I don't know why I'm not doing it, but I'm a busy person. I don't know. Maybe I'm lazy. It's always been my dream to talk to kids. It's funny that you mentioned teenagers, because I've always wanted to go to those assemblies in school, talk to them, especially like AFSP does some organizations like that. You go in and you talk to kids about how important it is, of how big your emotions are, right? Like me personally, someone with BPD, my emotions, I probably feel them at the level of a teenager, the amount of intensity and, you know, uncontrollable emotions that I feel very connected to teenagers in that way. And also because most of my struggles were for teenagers. So, and this world is so different than when I was growing up, you know.
How old are you now? You said 29?
Yeah, I'll be 30 in March.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's so different.
Yeah. I also, and I hate always bringing up the internet thing and mental health, but you can't ignore internet and mental health. You cannot ignore social media and mental health. You know, it's so great and so dangerous at the same time, which is why it's really important to discuss mental health also in terms of how the future is changing.
I think I was listening to the Daily podcast, and they were talking about adolescent mental health. And they said that from 2007, I believe 2006, 2007, suicidal ideation and suicidal attempts has increased by 300%. And I believe it. And they were saying, we can't pinpoint a specific like social media platform, but they were like, this is a huge part of it. And also they were talking about how puberty is happening earlier. So you have like the combination of puberty and hormones are even like racing, and you don't know how to manage your hormones, right? That's so, and it's a prolonged process.
Yeah.
And you throw the alienation that social media creates and this world of comparing and bullying, and it's awful. I'm so grateful I wasn't there.
Exactly. I always think about that when I see pictures, really embarrassing pictures. I'm like, no one can see what I was doing in the 2000s, early 2000s. No one has proof. No one, you have memories and that's it. Yeah. But it is true. I try, and like, as someone who has like a large social media presence, I try to kind of educate my siblings on it, you know, especially my 18-year-old sister, because she's 18, she's in college, she has social media and she's beautiful, but I'm so scared. But that idea of beauty is really going to fuck with her as she gets older. You know, if I had that when I was a kid, you know, bullying was hard enough when I was a kid, you know, but I would rather be pushed into a locker than have all these gorgeous faces that I'm looking at every single day as I scroll and I scroll and scroll and wonder, why don't I look like that? You know, why don't I have this much money? Why don't I have a mansion? You know,
right.
You have to be really careful with that. You know, someone said, we're only supposed to see like the opinions of like our 15 to 20 person tribe. And now we're seeing the opinions of millions of people, and that's affecting our mental health.
Yeah. I mean, I would, it's insane. I feel like, especially with teens, even, and it's funny, I talk to them and like, we do a lot of psychoeducation with my, I see mm-hmm. teens and I see adults, but with the teens, I'm like, I don't think, and I try to give them education, like, even if you're not thinking, me scrolling, me on being on TikTok for like hours is fucking with my mental health. Mm-hmm. Even if you don't see it, I'm like, I have an inkling that that actually is impacting you. And we talk about like just ways to like do experiments, like be on it less, but it's funny because they're like, it's fine, it doesn't bother me. And like, I don't know if it consciously bothers you, but like, we're, especially when the issues are body image, or it's like feeling like, if they're like, a lot of clients I work with are biracial, just feeling like they're not white enough or not like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Brown enough or black. Like, it just, it's like something, and it's because of all that they're, well, I mean, there's cultural, people are actually telling them this, but then you just have this vast amount of just strangers that you're yeah. comparing yourself to all the time. I mean, high school and middle school are already difficult. And then you have like thousands and thousands and millions of people to further compare yourself to. And they're funny. Some of them are just so resistant to that idea. And I'm like, yeah. I'm not trying to say it's bad. It's the way of the world. Like, I told them, like, I'm on it. I get it. But let's find a way to like navigate social media in a way that's more healthy or adaptive for you. So you're not in this mental space. I can't imagine, like, even when MySpace came out, are you familiar? Cause yeah, you had a top eight.
I was such a MySpace girl. I was a scene kid and everything. My name was Rachel Razorblade. It was embarrassing.
Oh, I love this. Do you have,
do you want to see a picture?
Yes, I would love to.
Oh my God.
You were like the top eight. I remember you would demote your friends.
You demote them, and then you would say like, who's your top one? And like, you would move them around when you were mad at them.
Yes. If you were talking to someone or dating someone, you'd be like,
digital bullying.
Oh, it was awful. I remember being like, oh, now I'm number three on this person's top eight.
Yeah. Like, what did I do? What are they thinking of me? It was literally, it was the worst.
Razor Rachel or Rachel Ray?
I can't find the picture. I'll show it to you later. It was Rachel Razorblade. And on MySpace, what they had were whore trains. And essentially whore trains were trains where you're trying to whore followers. You're trying to get more followers. And they had like kings and queens. And it was like a social media of like a game. It was really weird. So my name was Rachel Razorblade, and I would like add whore trains and be with like Mike Morphine and do weird stuff. It was God, 2000.
I was a little too naive back then. Like, I'm older than you, but I didn't know the world till I was like 20, 22. Like, I didn't know the extent of it. I was definitely in a bubble. But so I can't imagine doing this whore train on top of me being demoted to top eight was already like horrific enough.
I know, it was horrible, but I'm glad like that was really the only kind of thing that socially was like social media wise that was hurting us. So because, you know, you could go to school and go out in the world and be bullied, but when you came besides your parents, when you came home, you didn't, you know, you could be at peace.
Right.
Yeah, I would go in my room, listen to music. I'd be at peace for a second. But now I go in my room and I go on TikTok and I go on Instagram. And I'm like, now it's 24/7, which is what's really affecting our kids. And the fact that it went up 300% it breaks my fucking heart.
Because it's awful, but I'm not surprised. Like, so it was awful to hear that, but I'm not surprised. And I think the smartphones too. I don't know one person that doesn't have a smartphone. Like, and so we did, I mean, I didn't have a phone till I was 16. And even though that was like, you know, flip phone or Nokia, whatever. And it was like, you had limited number of texts. So like, you're never texting, you don't have access to MySpace until you're home at home. Like, it was just, so you had this, I guess, boundary, this like, not purposeful, but like you had this, I guess, this kind of separation, you can kind of compartmentalize, which was great. I just can't imagine being at school and then also being on my phone, like, being at school, those dynamics, and then being on my phone and being like, I got demoted. And now like, it's just awful.
That sounds really cool that you know, that you call it a boundary, because it was a boundary that you didn't even have to make. And now I feel like you have to go backwards and kind of create that boundary when you don't have the separation and you don't have the wall there. But I'm saying that, but I'm on TikTok chronically.
Yeah. Well, that's how you, that's a lot of the work that you do, right?
Yeah, and also my TikTok is very like I'm really anal with it because when you favorite things, it brings up more things for the algorithm, and when you dislike things, it shows you less of it. So I'm very, very anal about liking and disliking. So the things that come up on my feed are usually pretty positive.
I actually think that's so. I'm not on TikTok. I like went on it for a week and it was just too much for me to manage. But I think that so that kind of gives you a way to filter out the content you don't want to see, which is good in a lot of ways. Also, I feel like then we're in these like bubbles even more. I feel like I'm in this sometimes this I am naively in this progressive social work, social justice bubble, and then I don't see what a lot of people are
Staying on the other side.
saying. So I think there's a lot of peace that could bring. And also I feel like sometimes I'm naive and I feel like I'm pretty aware. And then anyway, so that's, but I like that on TikTok. I didn't know that that was a thing. So you can kind of filter out what you're exposed to and what you're not.
Yeah.
Right. Cool. Well, I didn't know. That's good to know. Like I'm such a TikTok. So wait, okay. So I want to get back to kind of, so you have like your own mental health stuff. I know you mentioned borderline and I kind of wanted to touch on that too, because there is a lot of stigma with that diagnosis and that personality disorder. And I don't like that it's called a disorder.
Oh, I've had therapists specifically reject me and tell me they won't work with me because I have BPD.
That's awful. Because
Because they said, yes. Because they said there's no medication. Obviously, you can do DBT, but there's no medication to like fix it, is what they said. And then they said the rate of suicide is so high they didn't want to work with me. I was like, I feel like
they
that's
actually
the
said
opposite.
this.
Yeah.
Awful.
I was like, I feel like that's the opposite. And they're like, we just can't do anything. I was like, okay. Yeah,
Well, because
talk
I
about
look at
abandonment issues with BPD when your therapist even rejects you.
for real. Well, but that also shows like how much that makes me fear. I mean, I already fear that there are a lot of therapists out there that are not qualified, but I think there's one thing to be like, I don't have the skills and the capacity to provide the support you need with that diagnosis. And another thing to be like, to say what they said is pretty much saying there's no, there, like, you're broken. There's no hope, right? There's nothing that can be done, which I don't believe because it's all about attachment to an identity and how can you like work through some of the attachment stuff and create healthy attachment and increase self-regulation. There's definitely tools and things you can do to cope with all of that. You just have to have a therapist that knows how to do that stuff, that has that trauma-informed lens too.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough that my therapist I've been seeing for the past year or two, he's trauma informed. He's amazing with he actually does a lot of studying on BPD and like did a lot of work on it and stuff. So he's the first trauma informed therapist I've had. I didn't realize that everything wrong with me is a lot of trauma, and he was the first one to really dig into everything that's kind of been these different catalysts to make my already genetic-ish chemical imbalance even worse. So it's just crazy what just the difference of being trauma informed can help a patient.
So were you going to therapists that were very untrauma informed
It
for the
was like a they yeah, untrauma informed. Essentially, you just go in and talk about your day and like your week and things like that, but I don't think they really understood like how every single day I was being impacted. But like as a therapist, like I've always heard that if a client stops talking during a session, it's like your role to kind of continue the conversation to keep it going as a therapist. And with a lot of the city and government run therapy clinics, they'll just sit there and wait for you to say something. So I switched through like five different therapists until I found this specific one who leaps and bounds. I mean, the fact that I haven't drank in 2 months, no therapist has been able to do that for 4 years.
Wow. Well,
Yeah.
so it's interesting you say that because some people are like, lean into the silence. So then you have these therapists that are like, we're just going to stare at each other
Oh my
for.
God. Josh, my therapist, says that. He goes, let's lean into this for a minute, but he'll keep the conversation
Right.
going.
Well, so it shouldn't be silent. I don't, I agree. I don't, I'm not going to let it be silent for like hours or minutes even. Like, but I'm going to, I think there's something to be said about holding space for silence, but I do think as a therapist, your job is to kind of assess the situation and be like, okay, this has brought something up for whatever reason, or this person is shutting down, or maybe there's avoidance, or maybe what I said was off-putting. So like, let's kind of like navigate this together
Yeah.
versus just staring at each other. So, but that's something that like I was even as a therapist that before I was licensed, they teach us, they train us to just like be silent. So that's also part of the system, I think. It's like we're taught to be like just quiet, like shh, and just like Which is, I mean, I think
helpful. Sit on a couch and just listen.
I don't know. Like, just like when there's that silence to like really just run with that. And I think it's not super, you can't generalize obviously with anything mental health wise. And I think that was probably generalized by a lot, or is probably generalized by a lot of therapists.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm the most perfect therapist, but I do think my lens is very trauma-informed. All the stuff I've done, I think, has been based on trauma and attachment theory. So I don't know, but I think for a lot of therapists, they're we're trained to be like silent and just kind of like let the person come to their own findings. And I agree in a lot of ways, but you need to guide. So
yeah,
but I wanted, okay, so like, let's talk about kind of the work you do outside from the advocacy work that you do, because you're a sommelier, right? And how did you get into that? And then how has that played out into your role with your relationship and role with, or not role, I guess, yeah, relationship with alcohol?
Oh God. Well, I got into somming because I had been working in fine dining for a long time. And I met my mentor, Fahara. She was the first sommelier I met. Super stoked that she was a Latino woman, because I was like, right, the most power that you could possibly hold is being Fahara right now, because she just blew me away. I would see her work and I would see her taste things. I would see her do pairings and I was just enamored. I just looked up to her so, so much. So I asked her to kind of help me and train me. So I worked with her a little bit as a cellar rat is what she called me. So I'd be in the cellar, like cleaning like the cellar, moving the bottles, organizing everything. And then after that, I was like, I really do want to do this as a career. And she had suggested I move back home to New York City. Can you hear that noise?
A little bit. Good.
As long as it's not super loud.
No, we're good.
So Fahara suggested that I move back to New York City to go to school. And she said, if you can make it there, kind of like everyone says, if you can make it in New York City, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
Which is pretty true, because I went through a lot of hell being an assistant somm, going to different schools. I got 3 different certifications because I have a neck tattoo and I'm a woman. So I was like, I might as well be overqualified. And then I started working at a few different restaurants, assistant somming. Then I got an opportunity to open a restaurant as the head somm with the company.
Wow.
And then I was just previously the somm at Frevo, which is an art gallery. And, it's hidden behind one of the art pieces, is just a chef's counter, where I was somming at. How that affected my relationship with alcohol is I drank a lot. I mean,
did you drink a lot of alcohol prior to that?
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you already were in.
Yeah. I was drinking since I was 14 and I had a really big issue with it for a while. I got sober in my early 20s for 8 months. I'm still proud of that 8 months.
Yeah.
And then I started drinking.
Early 20s, when that's when you're going out and doing all the things.
Yeah. And then from like 21 on, I was drinking a lot and using a lot of drugs. And then when I was somming, it was, nothing really changed. Like, I was drinking a lot already because restaurants is, it's such a massive culture to be drinking. So being a somm didn't really change anything, because also it's really, because it's such a more difficult job and you really have to be on point. I actually didn't drink at work as much because I was drinking at work. You know, I was drinking as soon as I got home, but I actually wasn't drinking as much when it came to wine, because I was so like, I worked so hard for that career. I was like, one drink is going to fuck this up for me.
Yeah.
And I said that, and then I got back into binge drinking and it really affected me. I almost lost my job over it. So it was difficult for a really, really long time. And then I think it was just a really big mix between drugs and alcohol. You know, just that industry. And then I got in 2020, because the pandemic, I actually went through a divorce because I got sober off of drugs. Me and my ex were using the same kinds of drugs. I wanted to get sober. He didn't want to get sober. So I divorced him. I got sober. And I'd been clean now for 2.5 years off of crack and PCP just from leaving that situation. Mm-hmm. So, and I was still drinking. I was like, okay, I stopped doing crack. You know, I need something, you know, I need to be drinking. That's when I started drinking more again, because now I was compensating for not having drugs in my life. And right. Now I was drinking. And then 2 months ago, I just started getting really bad again. And I was like, you know what? Me and my therapist discussed it. I had been hospitalized from drinking and then a suicide attempt. And he was like, you know, we have one common denominator. What's affecting your mental health the most right now, besides your diagnosis, is your drinking. He was like, consider it. Just consider not drinking. So it's been 2 months, and that's why I like the term soberish. I like sober curious. I like all these new terms that are coming out, because I'll still have a glass of wine, you know, if it's a someone buys a $3,000 bottle, I'm not passing that up. I'm a fucking psalm. Are you kidding me? You know, but I don't drink when I go out. I'm not attached to alcohol like I used to. All the activities that I do with my friends now, when I go out, I'm trying to go places where there is no alcohol. So I mean, 2 months without binge drinking, without getting drunk, has been, it's been crazy. I've been waking up at like 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, so it sounds like your therapist has made a huge impact. Like, this is
Oh,
someone you
huge.
trust, and that has helped you in your process of like deciding, okay, I need a break, or I need to slow it down, or something needs to get like something that's a change. It wasn't shaming. It sounds like it was like out of like having compassion for yourself. Like, let's do something that's going to be helpful for your mental health and keep you alive.
Yeah, and I think the best thing the term he used was your relationship with alcohol. He's never called me an alcoholic. He's just like, you need to have a healthy relationship with it. If that means abstain from it completely, fine. If that means only have it once in a while, fine. But for right now, let's just not do it. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. And it sounds like that spoke with you versus being like, you're an alcoholic, you're an addict. Sobriety is the only way out. 'Cause I mean, especially that comes with what comes with the statement like that, so much judgment, even if it's not intentional. It just feels like you're being labeled and boxed into something, and that's not fair for.
And I feel like it doesn't work for everybody, you know. Like, I've been to NA for years, I've been to AA for years, and I think those programs are amazing. They helped my dad stay clean for 25 years. But those rooms aren't for everyone, you know. Like, I'm Cali sober. I smoke weed every single day. Is that better than me getting blackout drunk? Yeah, also it's a medicine. So those rooms are perfect for people who need to just abstain. But I feel like that's a bit of an older kind of idea when we have new ideas of how, you know, what affects us and what is a healthy relationship for us. And I don't like when people are like, oh, you know, I went to NA and I told them I smoked weed and they kicked me out. I was like, what is the point? What is the point to be so closed off, especially to younger generations that are just being sober curious and trying to figure that out? You know, they've grown up in a world where alcohol is everything. And now we need to have smaller steps than just throwing them into an AA meeting.
Well, and I think too, with the spirituality piece, that's really triggering and upsetting for a lot of people, that they have to have this belief system that really, whether they've experienced trauma from religion or they just are like, I can't get on board with that. Like, that's just not who I am. And we're not saying that that's bad for anyone else, but I know that I've had a lot of clients who have been resistant to that because it's just the whole, I mean, well, multiple parts, you said, like, being like kind of estranged from the community because they smoked weed, or they're taking, psychotropic medications, or they had a lapse and it's become something that's just so shaming. Or, and then the religious piece, I don't think it's for everyone, but I also have some really good friends that are in recovery and do 12 step, and that's been their saving grace, and they love it and it works for them. So I was gonna ask you though, so your dad's, I was gonna say, how has it been with him, like him being in recovery with 12 step, and then and you don't talk about like him, but like, and then you having this Cali like sober experience.
Well, he's been Cali sober for a year now.
He also partakes in.
Once it was legal, because he has an immune disease, so he had to take it, or else he would have had to take too many meds, and like he'd rather just smoke. But him becoming Cali sober was actually really fascinating, because it kind of helped me realize that it's not that stigmatized. Like, I never really smoked weed. I went straight to hard drugs. So weed was something I experienced in my like late 20s. So he kind of sh he like showed me what weed was and everything like that. It sounds so fucking stupid. I used to smoke crack, and I'm like, he showed me what weed was.
Well, I think there's a culture though. There's different. There's weed's a it's in its own culture, honestly. And then California, you have, I mean, not just California, but it's its own thing.
Yeah, it's like its own culture. But before that, my dad had never seen me sober. This is the first time in my whole, besides when I was like 13, this is the first time in my entire almost 30 years that my dad has seen me clean, like minus the weed. I won't count that. You know, this is the first time in his life he's seen me not drinking, not doing drugs, you know. So it's actually right now is such a weird learning experience for me, because I'm living with my dad right now because I'm waiting for my visa to clear since I'm moving to Barcelona. So it's actually even better because we get to interact every single day and he gets to see how it's been changing me. And we're closer now because of it, because I'm not coming home, you know, drunk or annoying or blacked out, you know, and it's actually really fascinating for the past 2 months to see how much closer we've gotten when I took alcohol out of the mix, because he's not always worried about me and I'm waking up, I'm getting the shit I have to get done. You know, he can see I have more drive, I'm doing a lot more things because I'm not hungover all the time.
Yeah. So it's for him, it's been like he's about whatever method works that's gonna.
Yep. He's like, whatever works, let it, like when I run out of weed, because I get really, really anxious when I don't have my medical, he'll just like go pick it up for me and be like, this is better for you. I want you to be safe. I want you to be fine. So he's super supportive about it.
That's great. Cause I do know like folks that are 12 step and that's that is their religion. It's, but it sounds like he's for his own health and medical stuff has been like, I need an alternative. Like I can't, there needs to be a different way. But it's good that
he mixes the two. He mixes them because, like, he'll say people's places things, which is very common, you know, and he reminds me of that. People places things. You know, I've gone to some bars and hung out with friends, you know, while I've been on this soberish journey, but not often, maybe twice, because I usually leave early because I get quite uncomfortable. But he'll mix things. He'll tell me, he'll kind of do like speeches that he's heard in rooms before. He'll tell me people's places, things. He'll go over some steps with me, but he also mixes that with this Cali sober culture and this being accepting of, you know, different people's journeys with different substances, which has really helped, because when I was growing up, it was very strict, very religious, very, you know, not good.
Yeah. Well, and I think the rigidity is what we're not, it's not driving anymore for a lot of people, especially
we're like not driving anywhere for anyone in any subject anymore.
Right. So I think that flexibility and the ability to be like, it's harm reduction. Like if weed's better than taking opiates, like if, you know what I mean? Like if this is going to be better for your physical health or your mental health, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, function and you know what I mean? Have your relationships, like work, make money, like have a stable life. Why not? I think that there's just, and I think a lot of it's just like deep-rooted stigma and generational trauma and just our world and where it's at.
Our world and how everything is happening. It's like that little dog meme where everything's on fire around him. He's like, I'm fine. I'm fine.
Have you, so you're going to Spain to study?
I'm going to study Spanish. I'm going to a formal language school for 7 months.
So cool.
Yeah. Okay. I want to learn it because it's really good for my career, because I have an internship in Spain in a couple years, but I need to be fluent. And also I really want to move to South America. So I was like, why not just leave and learn the language?
So cool. So as you're preparing, like, and you know, you mentioned like anxiety and mental health stuff, like how are you feeling about this upcoming move? And also too, like having this relationship with alcohol, like I know. Just tell me about that. Like, what are your thoughts going into that?
Oh God, I'm feeling pretty good. I mean, like money is my biggest struggle right now, but my thing is I always kind of make things happen by the skin of my teeth. I'm not always exactly sure how. So I'm nervous, you know, I'm hoping that visa goes through, but there's really no reason that it shouldn't. Alcohol wise, you know, I'll be in Spain, but I know they have a big wine culture, obviously. I mean, that's why I'm going there. I feel like I should like set some boundaries now and kind of what I'm going to do. I did that with my therapist, like certain boundaries of like who I'll be hanging out with and places that I'll be initially hanging out in when I'm new, when I don't know the environment and I don't know the culture, because that could be even more dangerous when you go into something.
Yeah.
So I'm just being really cautious and I'm being what's the word I'm looking for? I'm just being really structured in kind of how I'm planning on, getting there and what I'm planning on doing. I really just want to focus on school. I mean, I'll have some fun, but my main thing is I want to focus on school. I think that will help, kind of be another motivator, something that I don't want to let down or anything or kind of mess up. So it's nerve-wracking, but I want to do it. I've always wanted to leave the country, I've never been a big fan of being here, and now I get to finally go.
I'm like, take me with you. It's
I
not.
know. Look, the second that verdict came down a few months ago, I applied for my visa.
Yeah, really? Was that the series?
That was the reason.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I it's mind blowing.
Yeah, it's
So
hard.
yeah, you get a little bit of a respite from that, and that'll be nice. Another thing I really wanted to touch on really, really quickly, and I don't want to like just go over it too quickly, but as far as a work too, with like, I guess, how is it like being in this community and being kind of this like face for mental health and suicide awareness and like really heavy shit? Like, how do you take care of yourself? What are some of the things you do, right? Because that can be really, I mean, that can weigh on you.
I mean,
Not you, all of us, but like that's a big, that's, and then in times like these, like you're talking, all the things are difficult.
I feel like my therapist says this too, because he says, you're constantly in this. You're constantly, whether it's on social media or physically volunteering, like I'm surrounded by parents who've lost their kids to suicide, kids who have tried to commit suicide, or die by suicide. I try not to say commit because it's not a choice. People who have died by suicide have attempted. I am surrounded by it a lot, but I feel comfortable here because I belong here. As a survivor, I belong here to tell people and to, educate people, and not just to educate people, because it's not like I know I'm gonna save everyone. I know I'm not. It's been proof I've lost friends, but I can educate people that are still here, and I can be there for people who aren't there. The way that I take care of myself is I just remind myself that I'm doing it for a purpose, and I don't need anyone to tell me I'm doing it for a purpose. I know I make a difference, whether it's a tiny, tiny bit or a lot of bit. I take care of myself in my self-care ways, bubble baths and things like that. But all I have to do is remind myself that this is a second chance for me. Nothing really scares me anymore. I think that's why I've been quite successful. I've had two careers and I have a successful, social media presence where I can help people who are sick. And I think that's because after my attempted suicide, everything else after that is new. It's like a video game. It's like restarting. I can do everything differently now. I can help people now. And that's kind of self-care in itself. It's just how honest I am with myself and how honest I am with other people. When we started and I said my whole shtick is being honest and being brutally honest, whether it be on social media or whether it be when I speak to people, I'd rather be embarrassed than not be myself. So this deep kind of abrasive honesty is honestly my biggest self-care for me.
Yeah. Like it's empowering. Like
Yeah,
you find strength from it.
empowering. Whatever goes wrong, but I know at the end of the night when I put my head down in bed, I was honest.
Yeah. Well, and I think when you live with this idea of trying to people please or being like fit, molding yourself to fit in whatever box or quiet yourself or shrink yourself down, I mean, that's like a short-term solution for some people and never, I don't like, and I think that's why a lot of people not, and there's lots of reasons why people end up contemplating suicide or completing it is just not feeling like they're worth anything or that they can be themselves or that people understand them and not believing that there's a way out from, from, and so I think when you can just embrace like, this is who I am, this is my meaning, this is, I think it's so liberating in so many ways. As painful it can be sometimes, it can be super liberating. It
hurts like hell.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not easy. It's because
I know. And I feel stupid like sitting here like, yeah, I'm so honest. Like I lay my head down on my silk pillow at night. Everything's good. No, like I'm crying on the kitchen floor. Like I'm cuddling my dogs, telling them to fix me. Like it's not easy. You know, I've been broken a million times over for being so vulnerable, but at this point, you know, we're all going to die. So, you know, I might as well, even if I'm pretending, you know, I might as well pretend I have meaning because I need to stick around.
Yeah. Well, but it sounds like bigger picture, knowing you're connected, knowing you're part of a bigger thing too has helped. So regardless of like, if people like how you show up or not, that there's going to be one person that can like feel connected to you and feel like I have this one, like I know this person gets me and gets the pain and suffering that I'm going through. And I think that's the thing with suicide. People don't like to talk about it, but it's really that having that, those thoughts and feeling like there's the only way out is because of that pain and suffering. I really have a hard time when people say it's selfish because you don't believe in that state that you're hurting other people. You're like, I'm doing everyone a
favor.
Right. And so I really struggle when people go to that because it's like, it's depression. It's like trauma. It's feeling like you have absolutely no way out. And so I think when people, and it's hard when you have, I personally haven't struggled with, I've struggled with lots of things as far as anxiety, self-esteem, body image stuff, but as far as suicidal ideation, I'm fortunate to not go through it. But I think what I've learned from clients and what I've learned from the work that I do is like, we can't invalidate someone's experience. And I think because of the stigma and people fear talking about it, it's so invalidating. So it's much better that we lean into it and learn from folks that are going through it.
Yeah. That was the biggest thing when I did my public speaking for Survivor Day event. There were a bunch of adults in the audience who had lost their children. Mm-hmm. And one of them was my neighbor, is a friend of mine, and his son was my neighbor and acquaintance, come over, swim in the pool, and he had died by suicide as well. So we were kind of close. So it was awkward for me to share the story with someone in the audience that I was close to. Mm-hmm. But I shared it, and my main thing, especially with parents, is I was explaining how it wasn't their fault. And I do hate when people say it's selfish, because people who say it's selfish have never been there.
Right.
You know, and it's like, you're right. Whenever it comes down to it, it's I'm doing a favor. I'm going to not be a burden. It's this immense, at least for me, when the BPD kind of comes into play, it's this immense abandonment where it's just, there's nothing there. You know, it's not sad. People are like, oh, how could you be so sad? I'm like, you're not sad. So yeah. I'm talking to these parents, trying to explain to them that when their kid went up to their room that day, they weren't, you know, it's not that they did it because they were like, oh, I'm gonna do this, you know, to mom and dad,
like in spite. No, absolutely not.
I was so clear that it's not a choice, and I had said that so many times, and I looked them all in the eyes, and I had to tell them that it was not a choice. They couldn't do it. And then parents would come up to me after and talk to me, and one of them was like, what could I have done? And I'm just like, how the fuck do I answer this? It's like, I explained to them the signs. I took this class called Talk Saves Lives, which, you know, talks about different ways to approach suicide and speak to people who have lost loved ones. Mm-hmm. And I was just trying so hard to look at these parents in the eyes and try to explain to them why their kid's not there. And the worst part was this guy came up to me and he shook my hand and he was like, you know, you brought me a little bit of peace knowing that, you know, she didn't choose this, that it wasn't my fault. And I was like, I'm so sorry. Like, when did you lose your daughter? And he was like, 6 weeks ago. And I was like, oh my God, I was bawling. He was bawling. But those are the things. Those are that one tiny split second of my life is worth whatever I feel having to deal with talking about this all the time and reliving it every single time.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful for you and people like you out there that are sharing their stories and like, cause that's a lot that requires a lot from you. And so I think it's so important to help other people understand that haven't been through it. And I'm glad you're there to do that work as hard as it sounds.
God. Well, I'm grateful for you too. Cause you're helping people like me.
I'm trying. I mean, it's like, we can only, you know, like, it's like you're doing your best. I'm doing it. It's all we can do. And I think that probably the same for you is it gives you like days are really challenging with this work. I know we do different things, but in a lot of with the same goal. And it's like, as long as we tried and like can say we helped one person, like, why not?
Exactly. That's the whole point.
So, and I'm just, before we kind of end this conversation, just speaking on, it's because it's Suicide Prevention Month, right? This month, September 1st.
Yeah, September 1st. And then the 4th to the 7th, 8th, 9th, to the 11th is Suicide Prevention Week, when most of the places are doing like their events.
Yeah. So what would you tell someone who's listening, who's maybe struggling with suicidal thoughts or who's struggled with it previously? If any words, not like necessarily like, this is how you get out of it, right? Because we're
this is how it never happens again.
Obviously, we're saying that it's not that simple, but what would be some words of wisdom or things you'd like people to know?
I'm trying to think about what I would have wanted someone to say to me if I had someone there when it was happening. And I think my biggest thing is that it's going to sound so cheesy to say that we want you here and that, you know, someone wants you here. I'm not going to say everybody wants you here. Not everybody wants us here, but there is someone that wants you here.
Yeah.
And as lonely and painful and abandoned that you can feel, there will always be one person. My biggest thing is when I want to hurt myself, because the ideations don't really stop for me. And when I really, really get to the point where I want to hurt someone, and if someone else does, you got to think of just one person. I don't care if it's your dog or your shrimp or your fish or your mom or your dad. You have to just think of one person. Mm-hmm. I keep a picture, keep a Polaroid on me of my baby sister. And that has actually helped me avoid attempts before.
I think that's, couldn't have said it better. And I think just having this those tangible concrete reminders is something we all need. And
I've got pictures of her everywhere. Cause I'm just like, okay, so like, you know, when you make safety plans, like who's your person? I'm like, my baby sister. So anytime I can get a nice picture of her, I just hang it up in my apartment so that
like, why do you have a shrine to me?
Stay alive.
No, it's so sweet. I love that. Cause it's hard. It's hard in the moment, those dark moments, to really connect with, like, sometimes the people we love the most, or especially when they're physically not with us, it's really hard to be like, we matter to them, or this relationship exists outside of this physical distance. It's really hard. I talk to people a lot about even like long distance friendships, like just because they're not there physically, it doesn't mean the relationship isn't there. And so I think if you can have those concrete reminders, I think that's huge. And so that's a really great suggestion. And I hope that people choose to use that.
Yeah. Like,
maybe not your sister, but their own sibling. Or...
Yeah. A trinket, a Polaroid, you know, I have this tattoo that I got of my middle sibling. So I always look at that too. I really try to ground myself with my siblings. That's kind of been my fighting battle. Is they don't know this, but it's been them.
Yeah. Well, it's been so lovely getting to know you. And
thank you. This is so much fun.
I'm excited to see, like, well, I know you're waiting for your visa, but to see your experiences in Spain and to see where life takes you, especially, I mean, that's going to be cool.
You and Kayla have to come visit. I have a guest loft.
Great. No, it's definitely in the next year. I want to travel abroad.
There you go. Yeah. You've got a room.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I wish that Kayla could have joined us today, but maybe we can do another conversation in the future.
Yeah, for sure. Tell her I said to feel better.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Generation Dry, a podcast for the sober and sober curious. If you like what you've been listening to, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review. For more information about this episode, you can check out the description. And for more techniques and tips, make sure to follow us on Instagram @GenerationDryPod. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you guys next week.